John Mayer, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
First of all, what is granuloma?
It's fascinating how much you learn when you have it. It's an obstruction in the vocal on the vocal process, which is basically connected to the vocal tissue, but not the actual, you know, what a singer needs to be able to sing. But it's just up top on it. And what it is a scar that basically doesn't get a chance to heal, and it keeps getting aggravated and it keeps growing. And so if you can kind of picture like an airbag on one side of the very top of your vocal cords, it's stopping the actual, you know, workable side where you sing from closing, so that I can't actually, you know, they can't vibrate against each other and make sound consistently. So it's just a matter now of, I'm not in recovery at the moment. I've actually just in a holding pattern until I can get the wherewithal, the discipline back again, the endurance to go through a 6-month period of extreme self-discipline.
Which means what? No talking or not even talking?
Well, there's no talking for the first month probably.
Wow.
And then there's whispering. But really what this has to do with is diet, actually, because acid reflux is as much a contributor as overuse is. And, you know, everybody's different, so nobody's quite sure to what extent, you know, talking, singing, laughing, screaming, and acid reflux has to do with the contribution to this problem. So you just have to, you know, be safe and do none of it. So there's no talking. There's basically, if you made a list of all the things that you enjoy eating or drinking, it's not you can't do those things.
You should do your recovery in a Tibetan monastery.
It's that. I mean, doctors have said you just live like a monk.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm pretty good about fashioning my brain in whatever way is expected of me to get to the next level as an artist. But that is not just a matter of how difficult it is. It's a matter of how long it is. Because, you know, when you're talking about 6 months, that's a lot of different weeks of different ways of thinking. So when you first set off on the – because I've done it once before.
Yeah, you've had this surgery before.
We did the whole thing, and, I say it's sort of like doing a cross-country trip from New York to L.A., getting to L.A. and realizing you forgot something in New York and getting back in the car and driving to go get it. You know, you may want to spend a couple nights in
Los
Angeles.
I'm sorry to be laughing about this because it sounds miserable.
No, it's well, it's not – If the problem is, if I were to decide it were miserable, then my sentence would be being miserable for the next 8 months.
Yeah.
So what I have to do as an artist and as a person, but I think I have the ability as an artist, is to just sort of repurpose this, where I think there's not a ton of different colors I can paint with here, but I have to figure out a way to repurpose this time so that it's not purgatory.
What is it – I mean, how does it sort of affect you when you sing? I mean, when you were recording this record, Born and Raised, because you were doing it late last year, I mean, did you suspect anything while you were in the studio? Did you sort of suddenly think something's wrong?
Oh, yeah. No, I knew it was wrong because I'd gone to a doctor back in April of 11 and saw this thing on the scope. I just don't think that I saw it as enduring as it has been and you know – a lot of times you can treat it just with what they call conservative therapy, where you're just not, you know, you're just not drinking as much or, you know, taking acid reflux control medications, and which I did. I mean, I do the work required of me. When it comes to making records and touring, I kind of feel this duty to everyone around me to do whatever the coursework is. And it just didn't work, you know, for whatever reason. But I also, the way that I wrote this record was by singing. I didn't sit down and compose this on a piece of paper. This was composed, you know, into a microphone with you know, a Pro Tools file that was, you know, 4 hours long. I mean, I say now that, you know, no one's ever going to sue me for copyright infringement.
You're saying you didn't sit down and with pen and pad and write the lyrics down? Because I'm looking at them in front of me, and that's what you do. I mean, you have a video where you are actually writing lyrics to one of your songs, and you didn't do that.
No. Huh. Well, what's the video where I'm writing lyrics?
Your Body is a Wonderland.
Oh, I did back. Well, that was also. I'm sure I did back then, but this record was all about like sort of improv, almost like it was very meditative. It was like I would tell the engineer to just turn down the music turn down what he was hearing in the control room, so it was just me. So it's basically a microphone going through the board, coming back to me only. So I could hear my voice with reverb on it. I mean, I still get such a rush out of pretending that I'm listening to a record of my own as I'm playing.
Huh.
And so I would like enter this kind of trance. I know it sounds a little bit highfalutin, but I would enter this sort of trance, and sometimes it'd be an hour, sometimes it'd be 90 minutes, and then at some point, well, sometimes you don't hit any of it, and it's a little disappointing, but sometimes you hit a moment where you can stitch two things together and it becomes an idea. And I remember, you know, for every song on this record, I remember the moment I went, oh, let's chase this, you know, and then you begin to sort of work on that one project. And I mean, I did write some on I remember using a dry erase board to great effect on this record. Mm. Yeah.
I mean, you have to sort of create like a framework, right? A scaffolding in your mind.
Exactly.
And then,
well, I have to have an idea that I think is strong enough to produce three verses and a bridge and a chorus, you know. Once I find that, and I've done it long enough now to know what that could be.
Yeah.
Whether it interests me. It's almost like a director looking over scripts or something. So once I get the idea, like, I remember one of the strongest ones I remember, or the strongest memories I have of stumbling on something, was playing the chords to Shadow, what would become the chorus to Shadow Days, and singing, I'm a good man with a good heart, and going, oh, that's stirring in one way or another. And then I remember thinking, well, if you're going to say that you're a good man with a good heart, you better explain why you think that. And you better explain that honestly. And so then I went, okay, well, I think I know what these verses have to be.
Did you know that you could be wrong and swear you're right? Some people been known to do it all their lives. But you find yourself alone just like you found yourself before. Like I found myself in pieces on the hotel floor. Hard times have helped me see. I'm a good man with a good heart. Had a tough time, got a rough start. But I finally learned to let it go.
I think the record's conversational that way because it's not as much of a thought out me penning a song on a piece of paper. It's me talking into a microphone. It's expressing myself at that moment that I heard the chords play.
I want to ask you about lyrics because this is such an introspective record. I mean, it's hard not to hear the lyrics on some of these songs. Mm. Well, I ain't no troublemaker and I never meant her harm, or, you know, if I ever get around to living, when are you going to wise up, boy? It's hard not to hear those lyrics and think, man, John Mayer, this is a confessional. This is a record about something that you have been through and you're going through and you're working through.
Well, I had nowhere else to go, really, but to get more real, you know? I knew what direction I had to go in because I couldn't get any less, I couldn't get any less genuine at a certain point. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of refocused and went, well, This is what we were contracted to do, you know. It's like, this is why you're here. This is your main vocation. And I don't know what it was. I think I do know what it is now because I've spent so long breaking it down. Part of it was like this, like, 7-year itch in a relationship with doing what I do for a living, where I think I just went, okay, I know I do this now, and that's safe, and that's settled. And I think a certain portion of that part of my life in 2009 was feeling like, well, this is grown up now, and I'm just there. I have tenure. Now what else? And I remember just sort of losing the complexity of the art that I was actually brought into the scope of, like, people's worldview to make.
Well, what do you mean by losing it, losing sight of it?
I must have gotten bored or something. I don't know. I mean, I.
And so, what did you do?
Anything I wanted to. That's the problem. That's the problem. I did any. I think the salient problem was that I saw anything I wanted to do as a road worth taking, as if like I was this exception to every rule,
whether it was destructive or not.
Yeah.
And I guess I should clarify for people who don't know what you're talking about. These are interviews you did with Playboy and Rolling Stone a few years ago where you made some sexually explicit remarks. I'm not going to go into detail. It's not worth
it. Yeah, I mean, I can actually talk about it now from a vantage point of, like, being out of it. I mean, I remember what it felt like. I'll never forget what it felt like. But I don't embody the feeling that much anymore because I just autopsied it so long. And, you know, and so for me, I remember going, like, well, I really want to do comedy. Well, should I be able to do comedy? Probably not. Like, if I had just been a dude off the street saying, I want to do stand-up comedy, I don't think I would have been let on the stage. Or not on that whatever stage I went on. I would have had to beat a Radisson or something, you know? And so for me, it took me 2 years of breaking down what this all was to realize my biggest mistake. And it's not about hatred. It's not about being ugly or mean or vulgar. I mean, my biggest mistake, it's a miscalculation. It's a vulgarity of miscalculation of, like, here's an opportunity that Rolling Stone or Playboy or whatever outlet is giving me to talk about my music or how I feel about things based on the music that I make, based on how hard I've worked and the luck I had in being born as with a little bit of talent to work on and turn into something. And I'm using this outlet to bomb at the Radisson. So I'm bombing at the Radisson inside of Rolling Stone. And again, I never would have been on the cover of Rolling Stone if someone had seen me do 8 minutes on stage. But I was so confused as to why people were interested in what I had to say. Why even some people, not even all people. And then I said, well, all people are interested in anything I do. And that's the fundamental flaw in the whole thing, was that my music career and the talent that I'd sort of worked really hard to get to a place where people knew my name and wanted to hear my music, that was at a very high level. The idea that, well, now I'm just going to go wander and do whatever I want to do, and this is all very artful, and it's just all amorphous. I got those lines so crossed that what you read in those interviews, among other things, obviously, is like this complete miscalculation in why I was asked to do the interview. And I think I understand it now. It doesn't mean I can go back and scrub it out, but I understand it. It was like, you know what you're doing at the beginning. You mastermind your career. And what happens is you just think you've just got this touch after a while. Well, if you correctly identify what it is your goal is, and then you work to that goal, you can win every time. I kind of stopped figuring out what the goal was, and I didn't really have a plan anymore, but I had infinite trust that whatever I was thinking must be the next marching order. Let's just do that. And so when it came time to do these interviews where I had nothing to say, I was going through a time in my life where I didn't really want to share what was going on, but I didn't want to be boring. I got in the worst trouble ever over and over again in my life from the time I was 4 till 2 years ago because I didn't want to be boring. And I remember thinking to myself, well, this is Rolling Stone. We got to give a Rolling Stone interview. And that's the miscalculation, because the only thing you have to do is be honest. But I wasn't prepared to be honest, but I knew that I had to be open. So I was open but not honest. And I think when you're open and honest, it's great. When you're like just open because you think you need to be but not honest, then you start sort of free associating garbage. You know what I mean? I just remember thinking to myself, like, well, this is Playboy, so I gotta give Playboy, I don't want anybody at Playboy to be like, this is a boring interview, I want to give them stuff. Well, you gotta be pretty far out of your mind to think no matter what I gotta give these people stuff, you know.
I mean, it sounds like in a sort of a weird way what happened with those experiences was probably really important for you, like a wake-up call that you needed.
Yeah,
I mean, you needed that to kind of go to the next phase in your life.
It's something that happens to control freaks. It happens to every control freak. Now, I picked the biggest thing you can get hit in the head with, for sure. Some people get in a car when they're drinking. Some people get on stage during an award show. And I'm not making a joke about that, you know, with Kanye or people. I mean, and I ran into him one time and I was like, man, I get it, you know, because I had just gone through my thing. And when you think you're a mastermind and you think that you can correct your way out of anything, you will eventually learn that you cannot just correct your way out of everything.
In your case, when you think you've, or when you've forgotten that you're a kid from Fairfield, Connecticut.
That's right. When you forget that the only reason people want to know your name is because of the music that you make that sometimes they want to hear. And some people don't have my record. Some people don't need to have my record. Some people don't like my music. What I was doing was thinking like, oh, they all care. And if they all care and they think the wrong thing, then I've got to change their mind because they don't like, if they don't like me, then there must be something they're missing, right? So like, if these people don't like, you know, you'd read these things, I don't even know if I can say the word, but D-bag, you know, is the abbreviation. Hmm. And I'd read these comments. First of all, why am I there reading comments? Hmm. And you'd read these things, and they'd say, he's a D-bag. And then you go, no, I'm not. This guy doesn't get it. I'm going to do something for this guy. So he says, actually, ha, 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 ha. Turns out he's cool. Hmm. Well, the bottom line is you don't need to be interacting with that. But if you're a mastermind and a control freak, you say, I'm going to figure out a way to make that one guy say he's not all that bad. And what ended up happening was I became so committed to the idea, which is not a reality, the idea of correction, that I completely lost sight of what the original plan was, which is you make music for anybody who wants to hear it. And I had just lost sight of it. And if you combine all that, what I was just talking about, with the 7-year itch of like, I know I can change vacuum tubes in an amp or play roughly a rough assimilation of like any guitar player you throw out at me from like, you know, like I know Clarence Gatemouth Brown. I'm like the only person in Us Weekly who knows who Clarence Gatemouth Brown is. You know what I mean? I'm like the only guy who knows like Albert Collins tunes note for note. You know what I mean? And it was like, I don't belong in those magazines. Mm. And the big problem was when I started seeing all that stuff as my problem.
Yeah.
Like dudes in the bushes, they don't want to take my picture. They don't want to take my picture because they think I'm a guitar hero or something like that. They want to take my picture because of what world I put myself in.
Right. It's becoming so much clearer where this record came from. Because this record is about you making that break from that part of your life.
And it's a very difficult break to make. And you know, maybe that's my greatest achievement, is coming so close to having the last brain cell that remembered what it was I was here for disappearing.
You are hiding in your mind, working all the time, trying to make it better than you got it. And you've been spending all your time searching for a sign that's never gonna look the way you want.
And really writing, I mean, I think that right there shows how much I care about being a musician, because every last bit of weight was on the side of the ship that was sinking. There's no doubt about it. And what I had to do was get as far away, and it's very difficult. I don't think I'll ever be able to fully explain the sort of Stockholm syndrome that takes place when you don't like your photo being taken, you don't like these people hiding outside of your house, but yet you fear it ending. You fear the loss of that relevance. Even though it's a dark, sinister sort of irrelevance, you fear the loss of it. And I remember saying, I've got to go get irrelevant. I want to be forgotten about. And so I locked myself away in Electric Lady Studios in Greenwich Village, New York City. And in a way, you know, this sort of starts the new phase of my life where nobody's clamoring. I burned out. That was it. Hmm. The story was over.
You were pretty successful at trying to get away from it all. I mean, you didn't talk to the press, and you kind of shut down for a while.
Yeah, the game was I'd taken it as far as I could take it. I lost. So all those little things you try and do to win, well, you lost. Well, now you have to pick a new game. You know, I really at some point must have thought, if I just say these right combination of tweets or things, and the entire world is going to go, I like them. And it's not going to happen. And so what happened was everything just shrunk down to the size of a dime. It's just a wake-up call, like you said. And so I blocked out all the time at Electric Lady Studio A, the room that Jimi Hendrix made famous. and started from scratch. It was like being a new artist, hoping. I mean, if you actually take all of the feelings and the sort of the narrative of the feeling, it's the exact same thing that a kid would say to himself before he had a record deal. I hope people want to receive this music. I have so much I need to say. I hope I get a chance to say it. I hope people are interested in what I have to say. I hope that I get on the cover of a magazine. All you have to do is put the word "again" mm-hmm. after it, you know. And I just fell back in love with what the original plan was, which is just, it's not about world domination. I had that conversation with my manager. I said, the world domination part of my life is over.
I mean, that must be in some ways kind of liberating. I mean, you were really ambitious when you were young. You mm-hmm. you moved down to Atlanta. You played the coffee house circuit. You were really, I mean,
militant.
And you were incredibly successful at a young age, right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And that's pressure. I mean, there's a lot of pressure there.
I don't know that it's I don't know that I felt it as pressure. It probably was, but I mean, you said it, you know, right off the bat. So it's just a false measure. You know, you don't see it as how lucky you were. You see it as something that you just have a touch for. And then you realize, oh, I was lucky. You know, I had to go back and like recode everything in my brain as like, no, that was an incredible opportunity. That you didn't deserve that. I mean, yeah, and as to a certain level, you worked really hard. Or you had a little bit of something to say. But that doesn't happen to everybody. And I think once I went back and realized that, I retroactively recoded everything that had happened to me as something to be appreciated and not just deserved. And now I think the thing I love the most about where I am is that, you know, a lot of people do come around to appreciating it, but it's not there anymore. You know, a lot of people do wake up and go, wow, so when I was 23, I had a hit record and everybody knew my name and it was cool to want to meet me at the party. And I just put a song out and it would do really well. And that wasn't, you know, that doesn't happen to every 23-year-old. Wow, okay. Well, a lot of those people who figure that out don't have the ability to put out another record that everybody can hear. Mm. So I was lucky enough to figure that out and still have the opportunity to continue on in a pretty large scale. So I just take that as, like, the biggest gift of my life is that I've learned to appreciate everything that has been given to me, and I'm still able to keep making music the way that I want to. And that's just like, all right, that's like skin of our teeth stuff, and I don't need to be any bigger than I get to be from the records that I make. That's it. I don't need to request any more of someone's attention than whenever they want to hear the record. And the way that I live my life now is so much happier because I'm not in that world domination scheme. I just want to put records out.
It's interesting to hear you talk about what you've been through, because the first track of this record is about a journey. The song's called Queen of California. And, yeah. I mean, obviously it's a journey from east to west, but it's a physical journey. But this record was a journey in so many other ways for you. And it kind of sort of sets the tone right at the start of that record with that song.
That was the mission statement for the record, sort of. I think Queen of California, you always sort of write a song somewhere in the writing process for an album that becomes the den leader of the rest of the songs. And Queen of California became the lyrical and musical sort of like locus of the whole thing. The lyric "Heading Out West with My Headphones On" makes me so happy to sing it. It's what everyone wants to do.
Yeah.
I mean, it says so much.
It's a visual thing, too. You're just looking at somebody on a bus or a Greyhound or something.
Yeah.
Going in that direction.
As a writer, that's what you try and do. You try and come up with one line that you could actually think about for, you know, 4 or 5 minutes and, you know, as long as another song, and kind of get deep into it, you know. There's a lot to it, you know. You don't head out west with your headphones on unless you're searching for something, you know. Just being able to have a hopeful vibe about something again, you know. It's actually about, you know, getting over stuff,
hmm.
which I think is why it's the first track on the record, because it's the first, it's a very relieving sort of breath of fresh air.
It's almost remarkable because, you know, here you are, you're this really famous guy, and yet, you know, and not to get to Us Weekly here, but just like
there
us,
you
right? You know, you have your anxieties and you
yeah.
have, and you actually really torture yourself about these seemingly
yeah.
tiny things. And then
yeah.
probably people who go to your concerts and listen to your records would say, man, but you're John Mayer, like, that shouldn't affect you.
I've heard that before. But you're John Mayer. I don't know where to begin getting any pleasure from, or any solace from
yeah.
it. You know, although I do, I mean, you know, I think it's a little bit of like if a tree falls in the woods the kind of thing where if a dude is happy in the woods, you know, was he happy if no one was there to see him? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a very difficult thing to come off of. When you were a lot of places, even if you were a lot of places and people weren't saying the nicest things about you. But the way, I will say this, like, the equipment that you need to put up with all that stuff and still go to sleep at night is just far too expensive because you lose all these other sensitivities. So, for instance, there was a day in my life where I could walk through LAX after landing and have 15, 20 people popping off flashes and yelling things at me, and my heart rate wouldn't rise. But there was a part of me that was dead. A certain function, a certain thoughtfulness that was gone to prepare for that.
Is that because of medication or because
No. Just because of steeling yourself for that.
Yeah.
So you begin calibrating yourself for that amount of energy. And to do that, you need to sort of be callous to everything. So you're basically trying to overcome fight or flight. Well, fight or flight is a response was based off of being sensitive to your environment. And so I became very insensitive to the environment that I was in, which is why I didn't write as deep as I could have or had before, because most of my faculties were devoted to making sense out of senseless things, right? And so now I'm extremely sensitive. I just don't put myself in those situations anymore. But when I do pass through, and now it's not 12 or 20, it might be 3 or 4, whatever, I get nervous, and I sweat, and I get anxious, and I flip out a little bit. And I think that's the way you're supposed to be, because it is a little weird, you know? And then 5-10 minutes later, I'm not flipped out anymore, and I'm back to being sensitive, you know? And I think that's the way, again, as a writer, you have to have things laid out. You just have to be able to feel things, even if that every once in a while is, whoa, that guy was in my face. Because there's a lot of people in Hollywood who are like, have to do that every day. And they have to develop a construct for that, you know. And I just think it's one or the other. You're not going to be able to be chased down the street and then go behind a microphone and sing Shadow Days. They're not going to happen on the same day.
This album is ready for fans. It's a great record, by the way, as
Thank
a fan. I really enjoyed listening to this thoroughly for the last few days. You are obviously not medically cleared to perform it, to sing mm-hmm. the songs. So what's the prognosis? I mean, when do you think that you are going to be able to be back out on the road and singing?
I'll be on the road this time next year.
Okay.
What I'm going to do, like I said before, with like repurposing this time into something, I'm going to take the summer, not think about diet or whether I'm singing too much, and go into the studio and record a record, either that has a vocal sound to it that's kind of just native to this one record, or come back after the surgery and re-sing it. But 34, I feel like I'm approaching something that I need to capitalize on as a writer, And I just am so scared of having 34 come and go and just have it be about having two operations, where I need to just have a couple months to see if there's anything I need to say at this point in my life. So, I mean, the dream is to have like 8 songs written so that I'll be like, cut me, I'm done writing. Because there is a moment where you get to, in writing, where you're just like, I just don't want to write anymore. I'll do anything. So I guess what I'm doing is looking for some way to like enter the hospital, like, let me take a nap. Like, I'm looking at this operation like a nap. I kind of want to look at the no speaking as a break from something. Mm. You know what I mean? Because it does take a ton of endurance. So it'd be cool to have another record to go out and tour with a year from now, so that maybe when we hit that stage the first time and we're, you know, calling from 2 new records instead of 1, I can feel like nothing was lost. You know?
Well, I'll be eagerly awaiting that tour. That's John Mayer. His new record is called Born and Raised. John, thank you so much. Get well soon, please, and congratulations on this record.
Thank you. I hope you enjoy it.